Dr. B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, August 28th, 2020. Birthday greetings to my brother Roby in London and my good friend Rita Cahill in Los Angeles. They share this day as a birthday. And 57 years after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech at the Lincoln Memorial, there was a gathering of protesters over police violence in Washington today. And I listened a bit on my satellite radio in the secret studio today and caught part of the speech by Martin Luther King III. And I found some inspiration connecting to the struggle that continues to this day. And while I'm no big booster of the Reverend Al Sharpton, I credit him with maintaining some momentum and visibility for this movement, and he could not have predicted that the events in Kenosha, Wisconsin, that began on Sunday of this week, would provide new outrage and energy for what I consider to be a very important movement. And there is new outrage coming from the police, joined by federal marshals in Kenosha. I'll get to that in a moment. But first, I want to update you on the status of Jacob Blake. He's the one who was shot this past Sunday afternoon by a Kenosha police officer. His father, who is Jacob Blake Sr., said that he had been able to speak with his son at the hospital on Wednesday, but the conversation was limited because his son was heavily and in intense pain. And what is truly just another insult is that Jacob Blake Jr. is shackled by his ankle to a hospital bed. He may never walk again. He certainly can't walk right now. In addition to the paralysis from the waist down, he has pretty massive internal injuries and is likely to lose his intestines. And the elder Blake said, when I got to his side, he grabbed my hands. He began to weep. He said his son asked, "Why so many times?" And I said, "Baby, they weren't supposed to shoot you at all." And the father said that the son was able to count the gunshots that came from the officer's weapon. There were a total of 7. He lost consciousness after the 4th or 5th shot. And the father said, "Why do they have that cold steel on my son's ankle? He couldn't get up if he wanted to." So that's a little overkill to have him shackled to a bed. And we've seen in the past that officers appear to be duty-bound to follow their policies even when they are ridiculous, often handcuffing individuals who they had just shot dead. And I suppose there are cases where the person appears to be dead and they come back to life and grab for a gun, and so in the officer safety, those policies are made. But in a hospital bed, I'm sure there is at least one cop armed right at the door of that hospital room. It is. Yes. And also on Friday, the Wisconsin Department of Justice revealed just a little bit of new details. They previously reported that one officer had fired a taser in the failed attempt to stop Jacob Blake. But now they say that 2 of the cops, Officer Rustin Shesky, who was the gunman, and Officer Vincent Arenas, had both discharged their tasers before Blake was shot. And it's interesting how little information they're willing to cough up. They say, well, the investigation is still underway. But as we'll describe in a moment, it's very hard to trust both the police chief and the Kenosha County Sheriff because of their history. Meanwhile, in Lake County, Illinois, the alleged gunman, Kyle Rittenhouse, age 17, is in the jail there in Lake County. A judge held a brief hearing this morning to address Rittenhouse's extradition to Wisconsin and the matter was put off until sometime next week in September. Rittenhouse didn't appear during the briefing. As you may have heard, on Wednesday, I opened the podcast by saying the name and offering a tribute to one of the victims of the alleged shooter, Kyle Rittenhouse, who was a friend of Steve Horn's cousin. Steve Horn, a journalist who was just recently featured in one of our interview podcasts here. And it took them a while, but the corporate media has finally tracked down the names and brief biographies of those who were killed. And the first man who was killed is Joseph Rosenbaum, age 36, a resident of Kenosha. He had followed Rittenhouse into a used car lot where he threw a plastic bag at the gunman and tried to take away his AR-15. The medical examiner found that Rosenbaum was shot in the groin, back, and left hand. The wounds fractured his pelvis, perforated his right lung and liver. He suffered a superficial wound to his left thigh and one to his forehead. Friends told local media Rosenbaum was originally from Texas, previously lived in Arizona, before moving to Wisconsin, where his young daughter lives, and he worked at a Wendy's. Rittenhouse then ran down the street, was chased by several people, and one of them was 26-year-old Anthony Huber. That is the good friend of Steve Horn's cousin. He did reside in Silver Lake, Wisconsin, and his girlfriend, Hannah Gittings, said that he protected her by pushing her out of the way before he chased the man and tried to whack him with his skateboard in an attempt to disarm him. And that's when it's believed that he was shot and killed by the vigilante gunman. And at a memorial held at a skate park to remember him and his passion for skateboarding, the girlfriend, Gittings, told the group that Huber was an amazing person. He took down an armed gunman with nothing but his fucking skateboard, she said. And the third man who was shot and wounded is a man named Gage Grosskreutz, age 26. And the report by the AP is that he appeared to be holding a gun when he approached Rittenhouse after he had shot at Huber. He's an activist who volunteered as a medic during the Kenosha demonstrations. He was part of a group of roughly two dozen activists who've been demonstrating around Milwaukee since the death of George Floyd, and Grosskreutz was wearing a backpack and a cap labeled paramedic. He was shot in the arm and is recovering after surgery. But the news from Kenosha that really riles me today actually comes from the Seattle Times. And I appreciate Paul Leto tipping me off to it. You may have heard in the reports from Jared Leto, going back to July and June, that in the CHOP, the Capitol Hill occupied, I don't remember what the P stands for now, there was a free kitchen called the Riot Kitchen. Well, the organizers of that kitchen were on their way to the protests in Washington, D.C. when the news broke from Kenosha, and they diverted their little caravan to Wisconsin. And when they arrived, they were greeted not by hungry protesters or people on the streets, but by cops in unmarked vehicles, including what we're told were some U.S. Marshals. So the Trump Palace Guard is already on the scene in Kenosha. And in a video posted on Twitter, it's described as the officers arrive in an unmarked vehicle or more. They surround a minivan that had just fueled up at a Kenosha gas station and was carrying what board member Jennifer Schurl said was a group of Riot Kitchen volunteers. So they had a van and a black painted bus. So it was just two in this mini caravan. So at least one member of the Riot Kitchen group was arrested on Wednesday, booked by city police into the Kenosha County Jail on misdemeanor charges of disorderly conduct. In the video, officers move in on the Riot Kitchen van with guns drawn. Someone yells, "Get the fuck out!" A uniformed law enforcement officer then swings a baton to shatter the glass of the passenger side front window. The officer reaches inside to open the door, people exit the van, an officer eventually gets into the vehicle and drives it away. Now, what is the probable cause for this strong arm takeover of the van and the arrest of these individuals? Well, four of the Riot Kitchen crew volunteers were released by Thursday afternoon, and four remain in jail. The Kenosha Police Department tweeted that a citizen tip was received about several suspicious vehicles with out-of-state plates meeting in a remote lot. In a statement, police said, acting on this information, Kenosha police officers located the suspicious vehicles and took up surveillance. Kenosha police were assisted by United States Marshals. Now again, what basis did they have to impound the minivan? The cops said they observed the occupants of the bus and bread truck exit at the gas station to fill multiple fuel cans. Now, you've got to really stretch this to say that those were potential Molotov cocktails. The most likely use was to run generators that they used to power the kitchen. Police say their officers wore appropriate identification. They said the minivan attempted to drive away and that the police ultimately forced entry into the vehicle. So this shows the mentality of the Kenosha cops, now emboldened by the presence of federal marshals. Perhaps they've been listening to the Republican convention, where protesters are all lumped into one category of rioters, looters, anarchists. And in a low point of the Republican parade last night, Rudy Giuliani was frothing at the mouth and falsely linking BLM to Antifa. He did it at least once and maybe twice, and he acted as if they're all the same. And, of course, he denounced them. And the Democrat mayors who run the cities that Trumpco believes are out of control and require the iron fist of our dear father. Oh, this is just so disgusting. Then we look at the media coverage and how the alleged vigilante shooter Kyle Rittenhouse is being depicted. Tucker Carlson defended him, saying, "How shocked are we that 17-year-olds with rifles decided they had to maintain order when no one else would?" And Trevor Noah responded, "No one drives to a city with guns because they love someone else's business so much. They do it because they're hoping to shoot someone. That's the only reason people like him joined these gangs in the first place. Yes, I said it, a gang. Because this is not the Battle of Yorktown. It's a bunch of dudes threatening people with guns." The New York Post, owned by Murdoch, a tabloid, described how Rittenhouse was spotted cleaning up graffiti in Kenosha hours before his arrest, as if he's a Boy Scout. And on the other extreme, there are people like me referring to Rittenhouse as a vigilante. And I believe that is accurate. Over at Fox News, they said he was there to maintain the peace. And there are others who have described him as a terrorist. And this illustrates the deep divide that is caused by Trump, the way he has managed as president, his often disgusting tweets that mischaracterize people, that drive racial divisions, that give permission for people to take the law in their own hands. And we'll get to more details of those kinds of confrontations a little bit further down my stack of news and comment. The ACLU of Wisconsin is calling for the resignation of the city's police chief, Daniel Miskinis, and the county's sheriff, David Beth. Quote, Sheriff Beth's deputies not only fraternized with white supremacist counter-protesters on Tuesday, but allowed the shooter to leave as people yelled that he was the shooter. And I don't know if you've had a chance to view the video from 2018 of Sheriff Beth. I saw it just a couple of nights ago. And it reminded me of this Neanderthal congressman from Orange County who I interviewed back in the 1990s, Bill Dannemeyer. He was running for the U.S. Senate. Dianne Feinstein ultimately won that race. But Dannemeyer told me that he was ready to write off an entire generation of black and Latino males because he thought they were just defective and that law enforcement is the only way to address it. And Sheriff Beth had similar comments. I'll quote, I'm to the point where I think society has to come to a threshold where there are some people that aren't worth saving. We need to build warehouses to put these people into and lock them away for the rest of their lives with no recreational time. This was in response to the arrest of five black people for shoplifting. He then went on a bizarre eugenics rant, claiming that the police's job should be to stop these males from getting 10 other women pregnant and having small children. Let's put them away, he said. And let me just pause for a moment here, because I shared with you the other day my angry comments about Mike Pence's speech, his threats of further police crackdowns on protesters, again, putting them all in one basket of rioters and looters and anarchists. And then he went on to lie about the shooting death of a federal security officer in Oakland back at the end of May, suggesting that it was rioters who had killed him. And there wasn't really a riot that night. But that was his characterization of it. And as we corrected the record in our podcast yesterday, the security guard who was shot and killed was the victim of a Boogaloo boy. And that Boogaloo boy is no longer serving in the Air Force, but he was a military police officer in the Air Force, assigned to Travis Air Force Base, which is just east of San Francisco. And on that post, Christine Kraft, whom some of my listeners are familiar with, a longtime colleague of mine in Bay Area Talk Radio, and a woman for whom my respect has diminished based on her Facebook persona. And so she responded to my Facebook post by saying he wasn't unarmed, had a knife. And when I challenged her on that, she then went into a longer post where she described the victim of the police as a guy who had five kids with four women. Or maybe it's four kids with five. I don't remember. But I'm appalled that Christine would engage in that kind of victim smearing as if his fathering of children was a driver that enabled the police to justify this flatly unjustifiable action. And yes, Jacob Blake was the subject of a warrant and a restraining order. And again, those are interesting facts, but they appear to be quite irrelevant to the incredible violence that was inflicted on him because he walked away from officers who wanted to detain him. Meanwhile, there are volunteers who are trying to clean up Kenosha. A lot of buildings are boarded up as the result of fires and vandalism. And the boards boarding up these buildings had slogans of no justice, no peace, Black Lives Matter. They're being painted over by mostly white, but not entirely white, volunteers. And cutesy little Hallmark messages about love are being used to erase the powerful graffiti left by the protesters. The WNBA and the NBA have agreed to resume play, and the boys' squad, the National Basketball Association, will resume their playoffs on Saturday in Orlando. The executive director of the Players Union, Adam Silver. Oh, no, Michelle Roberts is the union rep. Adam Silver is the commissioner. They issued a statement. "We had a candid, impassioned, productive conversation between NBA players, coaches, and team governors regarding next steps to further our collective efforts and actions in support of social justice and racial equality. Their plan includes the creation of a social justice coalition with representatives from players, coaches, and governors that will be focused on a broad range of issues, including increasing access to voting, promoting civic engagement, and advocating for meaningful police and criminal justice reform." And one offshoot of this is reportedly a plan to register voters at the arenas where the NBA teams play in their own localities. They're obviously not playing there because of COVID at this point. I want to recommend a powerful op-ed published at The Guardian today by Mike German. I quoted him yesterday in a news report from The Guardian, but this is his own voice in an op-ed. And he writes, "For decades, the Federal Bureau of Investigation has routinely warned its agents that the white supremacist and far-right militant groups it investigates often have links to law enforcement. Yet the Justice Department has no national strategy designed to protect the communities policed by these dangerously compromised law enforcers. As our nation grapples with how to reimagine public safety, it's time to confront and resolve the persistent problems of explicit racism in law enforcement." He continues, "I know about these routine warnings because I received them as a young FBI agent preparing to accept an undercover assignment against neo-Nazi groups in Los Angeles, 1992. But don't take my word for it. A redacted version of a 2006 FBI intelligence assessment titled White Supremacist Infiltration of Law Enforcement alerted agents to both strategic infiltration by organized groups and self-initiated infiltration by law enforcement personnel sympathetic to white supremacist causes. A leaked 2015 counterterrorism policy guide made the case more directly, warning agents that FBI domestic terrorism investigations focused on militia extremists, white supremacist extremists, and sovereign citizen extremists often have identified active links to law enforcement officers." And Mr. German, he exposes the top FBI counterterrorism official, Michael McGarrity, at a hearing in 2019. He was asked if he knew about the infiltration of law enforcement by white supremacists in the publication back in 2006. McGarrity said he hadn't read it and that he would be suspect of white supremacist police officers, but their ideology was a First Amendment protected right. That is not true, based on Supreme Court precedent. And German cites it in his article. So this is a very serious issue. And the corporate media generally does not expose these ugly aspects of law enforcement, the underbelly of the criminal justice system in this country. They also don't expose the frame-up of alleged domestic terrorists who happen to be Muslim, who number in the hundreds by this date. So there's a blackout. And Mike German deserves a lot of credit for at least attempting to lift that blackout. Here's a piece that I think is important from today's Washington Post. They take us to Tyler, Texas, where the Democrat who is running against Louie Gohmert was holding a group meeting. I can't call it a rally because you can't have big crowds these days. But word had spread among the right-wingers that this group had intentions that they didn't approve of. So hundreds of conservative counter-protesters and supporters of Trump, many with military-style rifles slung over their shoulders, swarmed the town square and began pushing and shoving and yelling obscenities. They pulled the plug on the sound system that the candidate was using. His name is Gilbert, or her name. I don't have a first name. I can't find it in this article from the Post. And here's another anecdote. On this past Monday in central Pennsylvania, a man who was marching from Wisconsin to Washington for the rally at the Lincoln Memorial that I described at the outset of this podcast, he was shot and wounded. The article continues, the aggressive actions of some protest groups, including weeks of fires and vandalism in Portland and elsewhere, have led to a pushback. A group of people berated customers at D.C. restaurants this week who refused to raise their fist in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement, though the confrontations were nonviolent. And I quote that because I think that's the insertion of false equivalency. Then they go on to describe Take Back America, Texas, started by Brian Phoebus, age 38. He's a military veteran. His membership has surged to over 10,000 in the past 2.5 months, and he vowed that members will keep showing up at protests and other events where they fear there could be violence. And in this confrontation in Tyler, the organizer on the protester side, a black man whose name is Tony Crawford, leader of Parker County Progressives, he had been in touch with the police. And when things started to escalate, he texted the police chief, "We are surrounded by guns and people talking about shooting us loudly." The chief wrote back, "We are briefing now. We'll have units up there in a few." But they never showed up. And Tony Crawford later texted the chief, "Y'all abandoned us, chief. You let us get dragged and attacked while you did nothing." And this was common in Portland last Saturday. There was a situation where Proud Boys or some other right-wing armed group showed up, and the cops were mostly focused on pushing back the Black Lives Matter protesters who were not armed. And this is not lost on black Americans. I just received the latest Ipsos poll. 83% of black Americans agree with this statement. Racism is built into the American economy, government, and educational system. Only 50% of white Americans agree with that statement. 69% of Hispanics. 67% of Asians. So Trump is really... He is provoking or enabling a rise of white racism greater than it was. It's never gone away, but it is much more present and out in the open today. Next item in the poll, which statement comes closer to your own view, even if neither is exactly right? All right, the first one, our country needs to continue making changes to give black Americans equal rights with white Americans. Well, 58% of all Americans agree with that, but only 51% of whites, 89% of blacks, and 63% of Latinos, 66% of Asians. And one more poll from this poll. Support for the Black Lives Matter movement has dropped from 63% to 53% of all Americans. And among whites, it's less than a majority, 48%. Among blacks, it's at 73%. A month after George Floyd was killed around Memorial Day, the number stood at 63% of all Americans. So Trump is chipping away. And his relentless attacks, as I've said, joined by Giuliani, many others on the Republican stage this week, it's working. Fox News amplifies it. And when it is matched up with the fear, Trump says, you know, you elect Biden and the suburbs will just be destroyed. What is truly scary is that this shit is working. And it bodes ill for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. I frankly don't think that they are prepared. If what we saw this week, culminating in Trump's 70-minute rant, self-aggrandizing, sanitizing the record to eliminate any reference to what caused the economy to crash, the impact on millions of Americans, they treat the coronavirus in the past tense, and they treat the calls for police reform with the utmost contempt and threaten back with the iron fist. And with all these armed right-winger white people, we are at risk of skirmishes that amount to a civil war in this country. This one surprised me, but two Trump appointees on the formerly uber-liberal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals based here in San Francisco have lifted a lower court's preliminary injunction on federal law enforcement officers' use of force, threats, and dispersal orders against journalists and legal observers who've been working at the protests in Portland. The injunction was put in place a few weeks back by District Court Judge Michael Simon, but the appeals court said his injunction was without adequate legal basis. Now, the third judge on the panel, Margaret McCown, maybe it's McCune, she was appointed a long time ago by President Bill Clinton. She said the government failed to meet its burden to demonstrate either an emergency or irreparable harm to support lifting the injunction. So this is where the Trump judges hold sway already. There are 200 of them, mostly young, almost all white, predominantly male. And they will certainly get telepathic messages to rule in his favor if they're not predisposed anyway. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Find folks like Judy Holloway, Patrick Garay, Ben Brotman, and Carla Mahoney. She's been a supporter for a long time. I'm grateful to each of you, and you set an example for others who can sign up at any time. All you have to do is pop by peterbcollins.com/signup. And it's easy to set up a PayPal subscription or just to click the link and send a one-time PayPal contribution. I always appreciate your support. So Facebook is drawing fire for its gross negligence related to several aspects of the situation in Kenosha. First up was the post from the so-called Kenosha Guard, issuing a call to arms for people to come to Kenosha and defend white rights. And this comes after Facebook's announcement a couple of weeks ago that they were going to police these pages and purge them. We don't know still if the alleged shooter saw that post and responded to it by driving up to Kenosha. It's only 25, 30 minutes from where he lives. And there are still lots of people who support Rittenhouse, and their posts are supposed to be blocked based on Facebook's community standards. But the Facebook community itself, the people who work there, there are 50,000 employees, and there are these all-team meetings conducted by video. And Zuckerberg took a pounding at this week's video call. Many of the employees said that they challenged their boss with questions like this. At what point do we take responsibility for enabling hate-filled bile to spread across our services? Anti-Semitism, conspiracy, and white supremacy reeks across our platforms. And Zuckerberg said the shooter's Facebook and Instagram accounts, which had no clear connection to the Kenosha Guard page, were taken down, and he admitted Facebook had made an operational mistake. And Zuck said the company didn't catch the Kenosha Guard page because the complaints had been sent to content moderation contractors who were not versed in how certain militias operate. On second review, doing it more sensitively, the team that was responsible for dangerous organizations recognized this violated the policies, and we took it down. But that didn't satisfy some employees. One is quoted here, "We need to get better at avoiding mistakes and being more proactive. Feels like we're caught in a cycle of responding to damage after it's already been done, rather than constructing mechanisms to nip these issues before they result in real harm." And a spokesperson, Liz Bourgeois, for Facebook, says, "We have not found evidence on Facebook suggesting the shooter followed the Kenosha Guard page or that he was invited on the event page they organized. However, the Kenosha Guard event and page violated our new policy on militia organizations and have been removed on this basis." The policy is just a week old. And here are details published in The Guardian today of how a fundraiser for Rittenhouse on Facebook was shared more than 17,000 times, including 291 public groups and pages with more than 3.9 million aggregate followers. In addition, hundreds of Facebook posts and memes featuring the phrase "Free Kyle" or "Free Kyle Rittenhouse" have garnered more than 70,000 interactions as of Thursday morning. That's yesterday. Many of the posts include stills captured from the videos of Rittenhouse carrying his rifle before, during, and after the shooting. One post on Wednesday afternoon by the page All About Trump 2020, which has more than 32,000 followers, shows Rittenhouse with his arm raised in the air and includes the caption, "Three commies down." Dozens of similar "Free Kyle" memes have also attracted significant support and engagement on Instagram, where they've been liked nearly 60,000 times. And on Thursday, Joshua Feuerstein, described as an evangelical Christian social media influencer, he put up a photo of Rittenhouse during the shooting with the slogan, "I stand with Kyle Rittenhouse. Share this before they take it down again." There's a really interesting piece. I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. It's a tech column in the New York Times written by Kevin Roos called "The Shift." He says, "Every morning, one of the first tabs I open on my browser is CrowdTangle, a handy Facebook-owned data tool that offers a bird's-eye view of what's popular on the platform. Most days, the leaderboard looks roughly the same, conservative post after conservative post with the occasional liberal interloper. But what sticks out when you dig into the data is just how dominant the Facebook right truly is. Pro-Trump political influencers have spent years building a well-oiled media machine that swarms around every major news story, creating a torrent of viral commentary that reliably drowns out both the mainstream media and the liberal opposition. And because we only see posts from our own friends, many people block friends who disagree with them. So we create these silos. And I have a handful of right-wingers who show up on my newsfeed on Facebook, and they offend me, but I do not block them or, try to dismiss them because I want to know what's going on outside my own silo. And get this. The conservative commentator, Ben Shapiro, has gotten 56 million total interactions on his Facebook page in the last 30 days. That's more than the main pages of ABC News, NBC News, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and NPR combined. Facebook posts by Breitbart have been shared 4 million times in the past 30 days, roughly three times as many posts from the official pages of every Democratic member of the United States Senate combined. The most shared Facebook post containing the term Black Lives Matter over the past 6 months is a June video by the right-wing commentators, the Hodge Twins, which calls the racial justice movement a damn lie. The second most shared Black Lives Matter post, a different viral video from the Hodge Twins, this one calling the movement a leftist lie. So, Russian influence? We're supposed to be on our knees and worried about that, right? Putin is influencing us to sow division among Americans. These are the people who are dividing Americans, and they are Americans, and they are Trump followers. Will we ever come to terms with it? I'm not optimistic. The other tech giant, Google, has declined to remove ads from a shadowy group that echoes Trump's misleading claim that there is a meaningful difference between voting by mail and by absentee ballot. Google took 5 days to make a decision to leave the ads in place. And according to a doctoral student at the University of Washington's Human Centered Design and Engineering Department, who had alerted Google to the ads, "This is active and blatant disinformation. I don't think there's any question it's a misleading narrative. The ads try to promote confusion for the public at a time when clarity is needed," says Kristen Clark, president at the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. Despite the stout claim from a Google spokeswoman, "We have zero tolerance for ads that employ voter suppression tactics or undermine participation in elections," they have officially approved ads that are known to be inaccurate. They're sponsored by a little-known group called Protect My Vote. They appear in response to Google searches for mail-in voting. And that's the insidiousness, again. You only see these ads if you make a certain search query. And it turns out that this group appears to be funded by FreedomWorks, the right-wing group called a think tank in Washington. And this is a minor issue, but here in California, the Secretary of State has hired a company that often works on Democratic campaigns. They gave him a $35 million contract for a new campaign to encourage voting and voting by mail during the pandemic. The contract went to SKD Knickerbocker, which has crafted successful campaigns for Democrats like Dianne Feinstein. And one of the people who is part of this firm is Anita Dunn. She's a top advisor to Joe Biden, a former Obama administration official who took time in between to lobby for TransCanada, Keystone XL pipeline operator. Today I'm posting a fresh in-depth interview with retired Air Force Colonel Morris Davis. His name came up in my most recent in-depth interview with Patrick Martin about the CIA and military veterans who populate the Democratic Party these days. There are 11 members who got elected to the House in 2018 who are either military or intelligence veterans or both. And there's a new crop, as Patrick Martin has described. And if you've heard that interview, I did put the brakes on when he talked about Morris Davis, better known as Mo. So I arranged an interview today, had a great conversation with Mo Davis. And while he is a conservative Democrat who's running in North Carolina, he's progressive on many issues. He's the guy who resigned in protest when he was the top prosecutor at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, because he was being asked or forced to use evidence garnered from torture to try to convict defendants before the kangaroo court there. And to his credit, Mo Davis today calls for the shutdown of the Guantanamo prison, and here's an excerpt where he addresses that unfinished business.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's really amazing to me that I resigned in early October of 2007, and here we are in late August of 2020, and very little has changed. You know, we still have, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the guys are still sitting there, still haven't been tried, and it's, 13 years later. And I don't lose any sleep over Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but it does bother me that the 9/11 victim families have been denied justice and maybe a measure of closure just for no other reason than politics. Because if you recall, back in September of 2006, when I was chief prosecutor, that's when President Bush had decided that the high-value detainees that were in CIA custody were going to go to Guantanamo and through the military commissions rather than coming to the U.S. and into our federal courts. The guys that got off the airplane that day in Guantanamo, the only one that's been tried, convicted, sentenced, and the case has been appealed all the way through the U.S. Supreme Court and is over and done, was Ahmed Gilani, who was involved in the East Africa embassy bombings. And Gilani is the only Guantanamo detainee that was ever brought to the United States and prosecuted in federal court. And that was during the Obama administration, and he was convicted a decade ago.
That's Mo Davis, candidate for Congress in North Carolina. We talk about voting rights, about gerrymandering, voter suppression. We talk about my fundamental demand to return my goddamn Fourth Amendment. We talk about the need for police reform. We talk about the vulnerable Americans facing eviction, foreclosure, hunger, and lack of health insurance. I think you'll find it very interesting. And if you're so inclined and have the cash, consider making a contribution to his campaign. He does have a real chance of winning. And I think his voice in the House would be a welcome one for many of the issues that I care about. So I have to tell you how painful it was to sit through Trump's 70-minute spiel last night. It's all the same grievances and white victimization that he has been trotting out at his mob rallies, and he's got another one of those in New Hampshire tonight. You've been warned, New Hampshire. It was filled with lies. And fundamentally, he demonized the Democrats, who he said would ruin America, because they aid and abet the carnage on our streets today. And he and his minions who spoke before him, Ivanka, Rudy Giuliani, they all paint this dark picture of America today and then attack the Democrats for describing the darkness of the Trump administration. And their bottom line is that Trump is the only one who can fix the problems that Trump is responsible for. And it's so incoherent. It's irrational. It is largely disingenuous. But that is their spiel, and they deliver it with high volume, like Kimberly Guilfoyle and Rudy Giuliani, and gusto, especially when they're lying, which is, when their lips are moving. Here's a quote from Trump. "Your vote will decide whether we protect law-abiding Americans or whether we give free rein to violent anarchists, agitators, and criminals who threaten our citizens. And this election will decide whether we will defend the American way of life or whether we'll allow a radical movement to completely dismantle and destroy it." So these stark dystopian film noir false choices that are presented time and again, based on falsehoods, based on projection of a reality that most Americans can't recognize unless you are part of the Trump cult. He also said, in the strongest possible terms, the Republican Party condemns the rioting, looting, arson, and violence we have seen in Democrat-run cities like Kenosha, Minneapolis, Portland, Chicago, and New York, and many others, Democrat-run. Now, voters choose, and well, hold on a sec. Before I get to that, most of the officials, like mayors and council members in major American cities, run in nonpartisan races. They may identify as a member of the Democratic Party, but for the most part, they don't run on political tickets. So, you know, every American city, just about, is managed by a Democrat, the big ones. So Trump wants to use a broad brush to paint them all as enablers of anarchy, looting, and the like. And it's so painful to watch him. He doesn't know how to use a teleprompter. And maybe Ivanka could give him some lessons, because she did a pretty good job. I didn't like what she said, but I have to acknowledge that she's a pretty effective public speaker. She generates empathy. There are people who think she's pretty. And so she does the soft sell, but she can read a teleprompter. And the way you do it is you read one line from the left screen, and then you look in the middle as you move over to the right screen. But Trump lurches from one extreme to the other, clutching the podium like he was about to fall over. There was clearly a fan or an air conditioner built into the podium, because his comb-over hair on the front kept flopping around, exposing more of his bald head than he probably wanted people to see. And it was this bizarre presentation, abusing the White House Rose Garden. Clear violation, in my view, of the Hatch Act. And I made a joke that I didn't explain with Mo Davis in the interview, because he won a lawsuit based on the Hatch Act after he was fired from a job at the Library of Congress. And we mentioned it in passing, and he said, oh, if we start on that, it'll take an hour. But Ivanka, who was given the prized opportunity to introduce her daddy, who has some bizarre attraction to his own daughter, she said, Dad, people attack you for being unconventional, but I love you for being real, and I respect you for being effective. Washington hasn't changed Donald Trump. Donald Trump has changed Washington. So I have a stack of fact-checking here. I'm just going to run through it briefly, because you know what a liar this guy is. A boast, I've done more for the African-American community than any president since Abraham Lincoln. Everybody knows that's false. He's freed a few African Americans from federal prison. So, you know, a couple of them appeared on the telethon. But other than his claim, which is really Obama's work, that African American unemployment hit its lowest level during the good times of the Trump first term, he has no basis to make that claim. About the only discussion of foreign policy was his boast that he got NATO partners to spend more money on defense. And the fact checkers at the Washington Post note, Trump has demonstrated that he has little notion of how NATO is funded and operates. He repeatedly claimed that other members of the alliance owed money to the United States. No, they don't even, you know, chip in money to NATO. They simply agree to spend a specific amount, 2% of their GDP, on their military. And that, in turn, is pledged to support NATO under certain circumstances. And one more totally false claim. We will always and very strongly protect patients with pre-existing conditions. This is the guy who has tried every which way to dismantle Obamacare, which is far from perfect. But he wants to leave millions of Americans without any health insurance whatsoever. And he's already achieved that because there are 20 million or so who have lost their employer-provided health insurance during the pandemic. Over in Sacramento, there's a bit of a crisis because the legislative session is about to wind down at the end of August, and all but one of the state senators who are Republicans are quarantining because one of their caucus members, Brian Jones of San Diego County, he is now infected with the virus. He's one of those people who refused to wear a mask and went to public events. But it has created a problem, and they have given special permission to the Republican state senators to vote remotely through the end of this session. Here's today's COVID-19 update prepared by Linda Lewis. The global total confirmed cases is at 24.5 million. Total deaths reported at 833,000. Here in the United States, almost 6 million cases now, and the death toll is reported at over 181,000. Yesterday, 45,000 new cases reported and 1,127 deaths. And Linda writes, for a better understanding of current coronavirus news, I recommend to listeners the latest podcast from Dr. Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, University of Minnesota. In the current episode, Osterholm discusses the challenge of reopening colleges, conflicts between federal guidance and resource availability, and the threat posed to public health by politicization of public health agencies like the FDA and CDC. He worries about the impacts on public health if a vaccine is hurriedly released, and we've got more on that coming up in a moment. And there's just no way that a vaccine will be ready by then, says Osterholm. That's by the end of the year. And that would put public health authorities in the difficult position of recommending against it. Over at The Hill, they report that CDC's altered guidelines that were issued earlier this week to say that people who have been exposed to COVID-19 don't necessarily need a test if they don't have symptoms. Well, this change alarmed public health officials and experts who note that about 40% of people with COVID-19 are asymptomatic, meaning they'll never show symptoms of the virus, won't know they have it, but can spread it to others who then become seriously ill or die. This is the insidious nature of this virus. And while CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield attempted to clarify the changes yesterday by saying people who had been in close contact with a confirmed case may be considered for testing, the changed guidance remains on the agency's website. A spokesperson for HHS, the CDC's parent agency, doubled down on the changes and Redfield's statement on Thursday, saying it amplifies the policy. It in no way changes the policy. Wow, was he writing speeches for the RNC? Here's a quote from Tom Frieden, former CDC director. It's certainly the case that when test capacity is severely limited, you need to prioritize. But one of the things that we prioritize is testing of contacts. You can make a pretty good argument that it's more important to test an asymptomatic contact than it is a symptomatic contact, adding that someone with signs of the illness can be presumed to have it, while it's less clear for people who appear to be healthy. Experts are frustrated that neither Redfield nor other Trump officials have clearly explained why they made the change. From the New York Times, two organizations that represent thousands of public health departments in the U.S. sent a letter to senior administration officials asking that they pull these revised guidelines on virus testing and restore recommendations that individuals who've been exposed to the virus be tested whether or not they have symptoms. The letter was sent by leaders of the National Association of County and City Health Officials and the Big Cities Health Coalition. They wrote that their members are incredibly concerned about the changes. Quote, as public health professionals, we are troubled about the lack of evidence cited to inform this change. The letter went on to say that while the new guidance allows local or state health officials to make exceptions, it will make their ability to respond to the pandemic even harder. And today we learned that the FDA commissioner, Stephen Hahn, who permanently has egg on his face for joining Trump in a news conference this past Sunday, claiming that the use of blood plasma is reducing fatalities by 35%. Well, Hahn has removed the agency's spokeswoman, Emily Miller. She's taking the fall. And she's been on the job just one day longer than, who was that guy? I'm sorry. These Trump people have come and gone so much. Scaramucci. Scaramucci spent 10 days as the White House press guy. And this woman, Emily Miller, is fired after 11 days on the job. And not only that, a guy named Wayne Pines, who advised Hahn to apologize for his misleading comments about the benefit of plasma, well, his contract was terminated today, but it's a pure coincidence, according to a spokesman at the Department of Health and Human Services. Emergency response to Hurricane Laura has been complicated by a damaged economy, tense race relations, and the pandemic, says Todd Terrell, the founder and president of United Cajun Navy. They're a group of volunteers trying to assist in the aftermath. He says, it's not just a matter of worrying if the person you're rescuing on your small boat has a virus, but it's also about making sure people are spaced apart when we're giving them supplies or food. Most important for us, though, our volunteer numbers are a lot lower than we are used to. And in an example of the wealth and income divide in this country, amplified by COVID, there is a massive laptop shortage in the United States. At Extreme Tech, Joel Hruska reports that there is something like 5 million where demand is exceeding supply right now. Slower port inspections mean longer stock cycles. The Postal Service has suffered slowdowns. Chinese factory production is pushing back, but there are supply chain weaknesses. And as more and more educational instruction is done online, the have-nots are people who don't have a computer, including a laptop, or don't have access to broadband. And that's an issue that I discussed with Mo Davis in our conversation today. In the United Kingdom, the British government has a new message that it's safe to return to work. Next week, we will showcase the benefits of returning safely to work and raise awareness of companies getting this right, a government spokesperson said. Interesting piece in today's New York Times, where they document in a graph the disappearance from major news broadcasts of one Anthony Fauci. Now, I don't think he's a saint or the savior of our moment, but he is the guy who has been more credible and less political than anybody who's appeared on the stage with Trump in the press room. And they show that starting in May, the White House essentially blocked his interview requests coming from major media outlets, but they do allow him to appear on shows with smaller audiences. So maybe I ought to ask the Fauci man for an interview, because he may not be too busy. I want to commend to you an article, I've linked to it, from the Los Angeles Times today, because they offer an honest depiction of those who are concerned about the safety of a vaccine developed under Trump's Warp Speed program. And they lead with a woman, average citizen, named Greer McVeigh. She insists she is not an anti-vaxxer, not at all. She's up to date with her own immunizations. She had her son vaccinated when he was a child. But she fears the development of a vaccine because it's being dangerously rushed. They quote McVeigh, "This situation is different because of the politics that have been injected into the process and the speed at which they're developing the vaccines. Frankly, I don't trust this president. It just gives me pause." She is a member of a growing number of people described as vaccine hesitant, people who haven't previously identified with the anti-vaccine movement. She's mistrustful of Operation Warp Speed. She said, "The way they are expediting the process is by doing things concurrently. They're beginning manufacturing before they've even completed the trial." So she's pretty sharp. And I put myself in this category. I am not unalterably opposed to vaccination. I have a kind of checkered record on flu shots, but you know, I've been vaccinated for typhoid and other diseases that I don't want to catch. But Heidi Larson, who is the director of Vaccine Confidence Project at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, said anti-vaccination sentiment is going into the mainstream. A lot of people you never would have imagined are now saying that maybe the anti-vaccination lobby has a point. Well, listener Dick Attlee prefers to be referred to as someone who advocates for vaccine safety. And that is a tag that I identify with. And here, we cannot be assured of the safety of a Trump-developed vaccine, not to mention the profiteering that appears to be already arranged. Fascinating story by Ben Norton today over at the Gray Zone Project. He says that yesterday, the U.S. Commerce Department imposed sanctions on a number of entities in Russia. These are the entities that have claimed that they have developed the vaccine that they are calling Sputnik V. Now, I'm dubious about the Russian vaccine just as I am about the development of an American vaccine. I don't think vaccines should have a nationality. And I think that Russia is moving quickly at the risk of those who will be guinea pigs for the Sputnik V. But on what basis has the Commerce Department announced these new sanctions on research centers in Russia? These were announced yesterday. They accused the blacklisted institutes of being associated with Russian chemical and biological weapons programs. And the Kremlin called the accusation absolute nonsense and sanctions theater of the absurd. And the newly, how can I put it? I've explained to you how they put this guy, his name is Peck, I think, in charge of the Voice of America and all of our propaganda outlets. Well, what used to be propaganda that posed as being neutral is now just batshit crazy. Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty accused these Russian research facilities of developing chemical and biological weapons. Now, I don't know if the 33rd Scientific Research and Testing Institute or the 48th Central Scientific Research Institute in Kirov or the 48th Central Scientific Research Institute in Yekaterinburg are actually bioweapons facilities, but I'd like to see a little more proof. And whatever happened to the idea that Trump is Putin's puppet? Shinzo Abe, the longest-serving prime minister of Japan, is resigning due to illness. It appears to be stress-related. He has ulcerative colitis, which, of course, is an inflammation of the bowel condition. Also, a great piece at Consortium News today by John Kiriakou, who went to prison because he confirmed that the CIA had tortured some folks. Well, he relates some travel advice for people who are challenged when they fly back into the United States and are stopped by Customs Enforcement, ICE. So Kiriakou recently returned to JFK in New York from Europe. He has an app on his phone called Mobile Pass that allows him to post his passport, flight information, and picture in the ICE system so he can breeze through immigration and go on to baggage claim. But when he presented his mobile pass, he was told, "Please come with me, sir. We're going to have you talk to one of my colleagues." Kiriakou said, "I know what that means. It means let the harassment begin." He was placed in a secondary room where he was forced to wait for 25 minutes. And then Officer O, spelled O-H, called his name. He was accompanied by two other officers. And O asked him, "Have you ever been arrested for a crime?" And Kiriakou said, "I wasn't surprised that that was the first question. I've said consistently over the past 8 years that I wear my conviction for blowing the whistle on the CIA's torture program like a badge of honor. My response was, you know I have been. You otherwise wouldn't ask me a stupid question like that, which has literally nothing whatsoever to do with my travel today." The agents looked at each other, and O asked, "What was the nature of your crime?" And Kiriakou was prepared. He said, "I'm going to tell you guys exactly the same thing I tell your friends at Dulles Airport when they harass me. I am represented by counsel. I don't talk to cops. You have no right to detain me. I'm a journalist, and I'm going to write about this incident using your true names. And you have no legal right to keep me from entering my own country." They looked at each other and paused and said, "You are free to go. So remember how to handle that situation." A little detail to Steve Bannon and his scam around the Build the Wall fundraising campaign that scammed $25 million from Trumpists. He learned from the pro, the master, the builder, who was lionized all week long at the Republican convention. He learned how to stiff the contractors because they lined up this company from North Dakota, Fisher Sand and Gravel. They put a down payment of $1.5 million, and then Build the Wall never paid them a dime more. And finally today, I know this is sordid, and we've been trying to deal with this all week, but the man who is admitting that he was the lover of Becky Falwell, the wife of Jerry Falwell Jr., who apparently embraced his cuckold position. His name is Giancarlo Granda. He's now 29. He said the relationship developed when he was the pool boy at the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami. "I'm talking to some guests, and I noticed this woman behind me staring at me, and she was noticeably drunk, and she was just flirting with me, and then we start flirting back and forth. Toward the end of my work shift, she's like, 'Hey, would you want to go back to my hotel room?' And as a single 20-year-old, I'm like, 'Yeah, of course.' And then she's like, 'But my husband wants to watch.'" Granda said, "Immediately, I thought it was a bit strange, and I backed off. Then she's like, 'Oh, no, he's not going to do anything. He's just going to sit in a corner, and he wants to watch, and it's his thing.'" This developed, he said, into a years-long relationship, with he and Becky Falwell having sex multiple times a year, while Jerry Falwell watched. Praise the Lord and pass the Bible, will you? Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it everywhere, including with Jerry Jr. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.